Welcome to Trick Talkers, a podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. We hope we have card games to talk about, otherwise we wouldn't have a podcast. Wouldn't be much fun, would it, Ryan? Who is also
Well, host. We did talk about Cube Rails games in the last episode, so we're walking the fine line of what's a card game.
That is true, but I'd like to think we tied it in as much as we could in between signing agreements with aliens back to Trick Takers.
Very true. We did do a good job at that, I think, which was the whole point of the discussion. So it was great. I'm glad the discussion went where it did. And we've already had a few people who've listened to the episode, which, by the way, we record the episodes on Tuesday and also release them on Tuesday. So we're recording the same day that that episode got released. So it's amazing to already hear from so many people in with discussion in regards to that episode and the correlation with cube rails and trick-taking games and climbing and shedding. So thank you so much for listening and giving us that feedback on your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate the feedback. It's great to see enthusiastic chatter around the subject. Now, I'm going to jump for a wormhole and take you to our first topic, first game, Ryan, which is very hot off the press from Essen. This one is Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard by, excuse the butchered pronunciations, disclaimer, by Gaetan Bouchanat. I did French at school, you wouldn't believe it. Olivier Cipier and Hyonil. And if that's close to correct and you are listening, then I'll expect my medal in the post. Really appreciate it.
I'm fairly certain it wasn't close, but you tried at
least. I did try. That's a commiseration medal rather than a congratulations, you pronounced my name correctly medal. So, Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard, Ryan. This game is, and I know you've played the original Jekyll and Hyde, and many folks are familiar with it. To be clear, the original Jekyll versus Hyde, because there's also another game with a Jekyll and Hyde theme that is also trick-taking, rather confusingly, but it's not published by the same folks at Mandu Games. So in this version, it's a cooperative version, but if you have any experience with Jekyll versus Hyde, which is a well-regarded trick-taker, then you will feel immediately at home with this one. And if not, that's completely fine, because this is a really nice cooperative trick-taking game that leans in gently. It has 12 chapters, and what it will do, it will give you the first chapter to help you learn the game, and the second chapter. I'm not going to give you any spoilers here, but they're essentially scenarios that you and your partner have to work through to try and fend off the City of London and the police force in the City of London. So there's a lovely little board in the middle, as per the original Jekyll versus Hyde, a little police wooden figure, and a Jekyll and Hyde figure. And essentially the game, for the most part, for the first chapter, just to give you a little flavour, again, don't want to give away too many spoilers, so I'm going to be a little bit elusive on the contents of the rules for the chapters, but first chapter, your objective is essentially to balance out the tricks. So do you remember, Ryan, in Jekyll versus Hyde, one person wanted to either take all the tricks or no tricks? I think that was Hyde. And Jekyll wanted to get a balance of the tricks between the two players.
Yep.
So in this game, first chapter, literally, your little pawn is going to move across the City of London, and that's going to be relative to whoever took the least amount of tricks, and that's how many spaces it's going to move. That's going to happen twice. You're going to see how far your pawn's moved across. And it's exciting. It sounds, when I'm explaining this, and I'm very conscious, it sounds a little bit, oh, is that all? But the surprise is, and the twist is, what appears in these little chapter cards, the story's quite nice. It gives you a little backstory, a bit of flavour text. And then it starts adding a few layers of rules which make it more interesting and make it more spicy. One of those is which, if you capture the cards with 8 on them, which is the highest rank, then you move extra spaces. What you and the player have got to do is essentially you're playing against like an AI opponent. So you have experience with a trick-taking game, solo trick-taking game for Northwood, where you flip over a card and that dictates what could be played to the trick. Well, in this version, you're fighting off the City of London. You're going to pass it some cards at the start of each round. And when those cards are revealed, that's going to dictate what the, I guess you can call it an AI or autonomous opponent's going to play. So you've got this really interesting crunch where you've got a system in play and you're both trying to beat it a la robo trick kind of thing as well. So it's, that's where the game is. And it's, you can't talk, you can't communicate apart from when you both play a potion or before you get your cards, because these potions are going to have various effects on the tricks in play in the game. They're going to dictate what's trump, what's the highest level of suit on the potion track. And various effects are going to happen when these potions come into play. Again, a throwback to the original Jekyll versus Hyde. Now, it's a bit all over the place in terms of explanation here, but hopefully you've bared with me because I'm really conscious. I'm trying my best not to tell people what's going to happen, albeit I'm a man who's only ever got up to chapter 2, Ryan, so I've not got much Jekyll versus Hyde of them up. Right. Jekyll and Hyde. God, this is hard. Versus Scotland Yard under my belt.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's two more chapters than I have of it, so you're further along than I am. Now, in regards to this being a cooperative game, it's also a two-player only game, which is also what Jekyll versus Hyde was as well.
Yeah.
Like I said, I haven't played this one, but I have played Sail before, and I know you have as well, or Hamblin Cave. That is a pretty well-regarded two-player cooperative trick-taking game right now. All Play's new version of Sail is out, so a lot of people are playing that. How much would you make of a comparison to that game in regards to the cooperative aspect, the tension that's in Sail that you find in Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard? I mean, is it apples to oranges? Is it just a two-player cooperative and that's all it shares? Or are there anything... Is there anything about it that you think if somebody likes Sail, they'd also like this game? Or maybe they would prefer this one over Sail and should try and seek out maybe trying to play or buy this one?
I think firstly, from a broad perspective, if you like cooperative trick-taking in general and you've enjoyed Sail because it's cooperative, because you're working together, that's an easy sell for Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard. That's why I got it, actually, Ryan, because I had such a good time with Hamblin Cave, aka Sail, that I thought, well, I want to recreate that experience with the person I played Sail with and try and share the highs and lows of a cooperative trick taker. In terms of commonalities, you've got the board in the middle, you're moving a pawn in the middle, and this one feels a bit more like a chase. You have to get to a certain space on the board, so I suppose you can make that comparison with Hamblin Cave as well. You've got two rounds where you have to get to the designated spot, just like with Hamblin Cave, where you've got the ship and you've got to get that over to the other side of the board. I will say straight up that so far, and I'll caveat that I've only got to chapter 2, for me, Hamblin Cave probably, this is early thoughts, I've probably enjoyed that more, but Hamblin Cave reveals itself more openly. You haven't got these chapter cards which you're going to have in Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard. It's a bit more of a mystery in terms of what's going to come up next, what's the twist, what's the spice, whereas Hamblin Cave, it throws it all at you and says, okay, here's all the obstacles you're going to have to get past, here's the ghost deck or the kraken deck depending on which version you're playing, this is what you need to overcome. So it's all known information, whereas I do like the fact that like, they get surprises. They're like little presents that come in each round and a bit more of that.
You can strategize a little more in Sail knowing where you need to get. Even though each hand, you have to wait until you get that hand to figure out how you're going to play it out. But like you said, you know your obstacles ahead of time. If I win the next two tricks, we have to make sure you win the trick after that. Otherwise, we're going to hit this rock and be stuck for a while. But you're saying in Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard, the chapters might throw something at you that you weren't prepared for halfway through the round or something like that?
So the chapters will basically dictate for the two rounds that you're going to play to try and beat the chapter what the objective is, what the spice is. It will also have a little on the bottom, actually, and I will mention this. Not only can you beat the chapter, but there's a little extra goal on there, which should award you a gold star if you were. It's like an achievement as well. So if you go through the whole game just playing and completing the chapters, they do allow, which is clever, I think, a little bit more replayability where you can go back retrospectively. A bit like when you're playing Mario or Zelda or video game and you go back and you do all the achievements despite completing the main story. And I did actually think that was quite neat. To be fair, it gives it a bit more replayability. Albeit with Sail, now in the new version, you can create your own custom boards and do whatever you like. There are cards that are taken out of the deck. And in Sail, there are cards that, if you succumb to Krakens or Ghosts, there are cards that are unknown or potentially will be revealed later on. So again, you haven't necessarily got full information from the cards. But players also have to make a decision at the start of Jekyll and versus Hyde. I keep saying versus Hyde. It's and Hyde. J&H, I'll call it. The start of J&H. Players will pass some cards that are going to be used by the City of London, which is the Autonoma opponent. And if there's any eights in there, the players have to pass them. And they can't say anything. They just have to pass them. So I suppose, Ryan, there is a link there in regards to card passing as well, albeit the players aren't passing cards necessarily to help themselves. They're passing them to this opponent, which could essentially do whatever it wants with them. It's unknown information. So from that perspective, yes, it will be very interesting to play more of this and get to Chapter 12, potentially unlock some achievements on the way if I'm lucky, and then look back at it and say, actually, now having played it all, is it better than Hamelin Cave? At the moment, no, but I know everything about that game because don't mean to brag, Ryan, I've completed it.
You've completed Hamelin Cave, though?
Hamelin Cave, yeah.
There's some new scenarios in Sail that have proven to be pretty darn hard. I will say it's still very impressive to be able to complete all five scenarios in the original Hamelin Cave because pretty much after 1 and 2, it's pretty tough.
It's pretty tricky. If you get a regular teammate to play with, then you get a bit of meta and it's great. You get that going. But I will say then, yes, so replayability wise, because I've completed Hamelin Cave, the person who I played it with has pretty much said, well, we've done it now. So I guess if you want to play it again, find someone else to play it with you. And I kind of broke my heart a little bit. I thought, what do you mean? You don't want to play this again?
I mean, I feel like you'd still have the replayability of trying to be better than your last time, you know, beat your personal best score kind of thing. It's hard because there's no score in that game. So you'd have to track how many tricks did you win it in or how many rounds and then always try to beat that. I don't know. Maybe that's one way to compromise on it.
Yeah, to be fair. And like you said, with Sail, there's even more ways to go at, and obviously different combinations of player powers with Sail specifically and Hamelin Cave. But I do think the replayability is there with J&H Scotland Yard, call it that. And I do think having these achievements and also introducing people to the genre and getting them familiar with it is probably going to be an easier in for someone who doesn't necessarily play a lot of trick takers as well, just because of the way it sort of holds your hand as you go through the early chapters.
I think I'll be interested to see how you progress and hear how the different chapters go. Of course, without spoiling things, just you saying, oh, these chapters are getting better. There's more twists or things involved, which I do find enjoyable that there is a story mode campaign style trick-taking game, you know, available. Even if it's a short 12 stories, smaller box game, it's cool to see that space is being explored more and more. Because I know there's Trick Legacy that is, I think you can really only get it on GameCrafter right now, but somebody designed a legacy style trick-taking game, but you play with a normal playing a deck of cards.
Yeah.
And you just print out these additional cards that come with the game when you get it. And I haven't played it myself, so I don't really know how it plays, but I just know that there's a couple of games that are like that. So it's cool to see another one evolving from that and using the Jekyll and Hyde theme, I think, is perfect for this.
100%. And I will go on file and I will say, for me, the person I play this with, it might be a better time than the Jekyll versus Hyde. Purely, like, I dig the cooperative trick takers, especially after Hamelin Cave now, and the feeling it creates of you're working together to try and beat the system. I really dig that. And there's potentially more meat on the bone here than Jekyll versus Hyde. But again, it's going to come down to whether you prefer to play against your partner or your friend, really, isn't it?
Yeah, which is, it's nice too, because there's Fox in the Forest and Fox in the Forest Duet. For a long time, those were the two options for two-player trick-taking games that had a competitive and a cooperative version. So anytime somebody asked that kind of question, it was usually directed to those two games. So the fact that there's another set of games available is also nice.
Yeah, it's going to come down to what type of experience do you prefer, adversarial, cooperative? As I say, I just think there's potentially more here, albeit you could then turn around and say, oh, well, you've only got 12 chapters, whereas, you know, I can replay Jekyll versus Hyde hundreds of times and still have the game and still have that experience. So potentially reasons to own them both as well. I don't think one necessarily is going to replace the other here. And I know for sure the Hamelin Cave will still always have a coveted place on my shelf, pirates and all.
Well, I do look forward to hearing how the rest of the campaign goes.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention on that game before we move on?
No, I'd encourage people to check it out and see if it's available. I know it was hard to get hold of coming from Essen. Probably I'd wait for it to come back in stock. Don't spend a small fortune hunting it down. And if there are plenty of options to go at in the meantime, that's what we always tend to forget with our wonderful array of trick takers.
Yeah, I believe this one is going to have a more wider print, so you shouldn't have too much trouble tracking it down. Like Jekyll versus Hyde, you can get on Amazon.
Yeah.
And most online local game stores or regular local game stores. So I believe this game is going to follow in those footsteps. So wait a few more months and you might be able to find this a little bit easier.
And beautiful Vincent Detrait artwork, as always. I'd be remiss not to give him some credit for the job that he's done on this game.
It's true. Those both versions.
Both versions.
Jekyll versus Hyde and Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, exactly. Great.
All right. Well, before we continue going in a spiral and talking about that game more and more, let's move on to the next one.
Next chapter.
Yes. And that is going to be The Academy, which is designed by Manny Dominguez. So I briefly touched on this game a couple episodes ago. And as I had talked about it, Manny, the designer of the game, was listening to the episode and messaged me after and had said, oh my God, it was so amazing to hear you talk about my game on the episode, and wanted to know if I had a copy already to try and play. I didn't, because it's a lot harder to get a hold of, because right now it's pretty much you could only get it at Essen. And If you didn't, you're still waiting around for it. There's only German copies available right now, even. English should be coming later down the road, but right now it's only in German.
And so don't pick up a... If you're an English speaker, were you saying there'll be a lot of paste-ups here, Ryan?
Actually, well, I'll get to that in one second, but not really. So Manny, the kind soul that he is, sent me a copy. So I want to say all this up front, because obviously in the reviewing world, one, you want to make sure that you mention that so people know, grain of salt. I technically got a free copy of this game, even though I was willing to pay Manny. I did tell him that. He did send it to me because he had a couple extra like designer copies. So anyway, the game is all in German. Every card has German on it, but all of the playing cards are all on the back of the rule book. Every number of every suit is the same rule. So there are four suits in the game. All of the ones in all four suits have the same power.
Okay.
All the twos have the same power. All the threes, all the fours. The only ones that are different are the sevens. The four sevens of each suit have different powers. But again, the back of the rule book at the bottom explains all of the powers pretty well. And then the player abilities, the roll cards, there are four of them. There's the captain, the mastermind, the team player, and the rebel. And all of those are also explained in the rule book. They're all like a single sentence each. So it's pretty easy. You don't really need to do paste-ups of any kind on the cards, because there's only really a couple people that look at the abilities when trying to pick them. So let me explain the game really quickly and it might make more sense. So the reason why I was interested in the Academy is because this is a asymmetrical ability style game with smaller hands, which is a little similar to a game that I absolutely love, Trick Takers, designed by
Broken. I was going to say, you got a track record for this type of game.
Of course, it's easy to spot. The premise behind the Academy is there are four different roles or different abilities that you can be each round. Like I said, it's the captain, which is the player who's going to lead the first trick every round. There's the mastermind, who is going to have the ability to pick either the round's ability or what trump is first. Then there's the team player, who will choose whatever the mastermind didn't pick after. And then there's the rebel, which you only use in a four-player game. And essentially, the rebel doesn't care about the three other players.
Rebels don't normally.
Yeah, they're just trying to win three different suits within any tricks they win. So what will happen is the beginning of the round, you're going to give four cards to the mastermind and then deal eight cards to each player. From those four cards that were dealt to the mastermind first, they're going to pick one of them to be whatever the round ability is or trump. And then they're going to pass the other three cards to the team player, and the team player is going to pick from those three remaining cards whatever the mastermind didn't pick. After they do that, the last two cards go off to the side. Captain leads the first trick. The goal of every round is the same for the role that you are. The captain and the team player are working together to have more tricks than the mastermind player. The mastermind player is trying to have either an equal number or more tricks than the captain and team player. And like I said, the rebel is just ignoring all of that, and they just need to win any number of tricks where they can get at least three different suits in those tricks, whether it's one trick or five. As long as they have three of the four suits, they will get their goal. After the round's over, if you hit your goal, if you made whatever your round goal was, you're going to get 1 point. The game ends after one player gets 3 points and wins the purple seven card in a trick. So the purple seven is also known as the ace up the sleeve card.
Okay.
So in all the rounds setting up, when I was talking about giving out four cards to the mastermind, you actually set the purple seven aside so it can't be dealt out as one of the round or trump cards. It must be in players' hands when you're playing the eight tricks, because that card is the important capture card. It doesn't matter any other round before the game. If you don't have 3 points and you capture the purple seven, whatever. Okay. It's just another card. But as soon as you get 3 points, including the round you get your third point, if you collect that purple seven, you'll win.
Right. So the magic is in the ace up the sleeve, otherwise known as purple seven.
Yep. Exactly. So hopefully all that made sense, because that's pretty much the entire game. You play round after round until somebody gets 3 points and wins that purple seven in a trick. Now, if the game hasn't ended, all you do is slide your roll card to the person on your left. So the roles are always in that exact order. If I'm the captain, the player to my left is the mastermind, the player to their left is the team player, and the player to their left is the rebel. And then the next round, I would get past the rebel. I'm passing the captain to my left. So that way, the captain and team player are always diagonal from each other. The mastermind is to the right of the captain, and the rebel is the last person. Now, if you're playing a three-player game, you don't use the rebel. You just use captain, mastermind, team player, and you take out a suit. And you play the same thing, you just don't have the rebel player in there.
Right. I mean, so the rebel player is on their own. They're a lone ranger. They're equivalent of somebody who's basically been given an IKEA wardrobe without the instructions and say, right, off you go. You're on your own. Set it up yourself.
sure, yeah.
I mean, I don't know how in the deep end it throws you, but it strikes me that the rebel is, they don't care. They're kind of just left to their own devices.
Pretty much, yeah. And I think, before I get into the deeper thoughts on this game, overall, I enjoyed it, but I think my problem was the rebel player.
Right.
It always felt a little awkward when you were the rebel player, because you have almost little to no control in the round.
Well, IKEA wardrobes normally are, right?
Yeah, true. If you have no, you know, steps on how to put your wardrobe together, you're going to have some problems.
In the lurch, yeah.
The mastermind gets to pick one of the four cards first, and then the team player picks one of the three cards remaining. That's a lot more information those two players are getting. The captain is working with the team player, so there's actually a shared goal, even if the captain doesn't get to look at something. Whereas the rebel player doesn't get any control over the leftover cards, and they don't have anyone helping them try to win tricks. They're just on their own. So if you end up just having a really crappy hand and you can't win anything, you're just stuck there in the round going, okay, well, I guess I'm hope I can do better when I get the next roll next round. And then you just pass off the rebel to the next player. And they're just like, well, I guess I'm not going to score this round.
Touché.
Or you get a super good hand where you have like all of the nines of every suit and you win all the tricks. And it's a little bit easier, but it doesn't make it feel rewarding when you are the rebel player who gets a good hand, whereas the person right before you the previous round couldn't do anything and they didn't score a point. So that was like my only real negative I had. So I'd like to try it at three players to see how it goes without the rebel.
Right, because what's more useful for capturing a purple seven than a purple nine? So card allocation, yeah? And you said one of the roles, was it the team player that has to, whatever the mastermind doesn't pick as trump, the team player picks it?
Yeah, so the mastermind picks whatever the round ability will be first.
The rule.
Or yeah. Picks trump. Yeah, the rule for the round. So the mastermind gets first dibs, rule or trump. Whatever they don't pick, the team player will pick. So if the mastermind picks the rule for the round, mm-hmm. the three remaining cards that are left over, the team player will choose one of them to be trump.
Okay, how do you feel about that? Does that seem more quite balanced?
Yeah, it works really well. Sometimes it can be funny because we actually had two rounds where the four cards, three of them were the same color and one of them was different. So the mastermind picked the rule, which was that single color, which meant the team player had no choice for trump.
Okay.
Because it was just the same color.
Yeah.
The only difference, though, is that it gives more information to the team player because they know which three cards are removed for the round.
Right.
Even if that color is trump. But it was really cool to see those decisions being made because the abilities on the cards for the rules, I should say, keep using abilities and rules interchangeably, but a good chunk of the rules were leaning towards the mastermind. Like it was something that the mastermind mm-hmm. could do, manipulate their hand. There's one where if they lose the trick, they can take any card from the trick into their hand and then just discard something else.
Wow. Okay.
There's another one where before the round begins, they just exchange their hand with another player. So there's actually decisions where the mastermind could just choose trump because maybe they have a really good hand that they need this color to be trump and leave the rules to the team player because whatever rules are left over could work in their favor. Like maybe all three rules that they pass to the team player are positives for the mastermind to do something. So you don't always necessarily need to pick the rule if you're the mastermind. You do have the option to pick trump sometimes if you wanted.
Did you set three players, you lose the rebel?
Yeah, you lose the rebel in one suit. Just not the purple one. I'm blanking on it right now. I think it's the blue suit.
Right, so is that then the sweet... Are you saying then that might be the sweet spot because you then haven't got the rebel? So you're keeping the good things that you like about the game without the rebel being involved?
Yeah, because the 2v1 part of the game is really interesting. And I think that's where I found, and the four of us that played, we found the most enjoyment was when you were the captain, the mastermind, or the team player. The rebel player always just felt kind of like the odd one out and was just like, okay, I guess I'm here to mess with people. You could still try to help one player or another. Like if the mastermind has 2 points already and you think they're going to get their third and maybe they've already won the purple seven, you can just try and work to destroy them and make sure they don't win, but you might not succeed at your own goal anyways.
Okay, so it sounds like the game is a lot of this, the mastermind has their fair share in it in terms of rules, etc., things to contend with on the table and decide. So in terms of chaos level, and this might depend on player count, of course, Ryan, as well. With games like Gadget Trick, which is, you know, you get a gadget, you get an asymmetrical rule that allows you to break the rules of the game. We've got Trick Takers, where you get your own player power that you can do something fun with. Other games like that, Stickmeister maybe. Where does this one land?
It's quite chaotic. I don't think it's chaotic as Gadget Trick.
Okay.
It's probably not as chaotic as Trick Takers either, only because in Trick Takers, there's multiple abilities on top of multiple characters, on top of the deck makeup and having the like Skull King hierarchy of Trump, whereas in this one, it's just one suit and that's it. So it's a little bit more reined in. There's 8 tricks, so it's actually a relatively medium-sized hand to smaller hand. The abilities for the round is truly what makes the game chaotic. Right. There's one where you can swap your role.
That's wild.
The mastermind has the ability before the first trick to swap the role with anybody else.
Right, so they're probably going to pick the rebel then.
Of course.
Right, of course.
There's one where after each trick, the mastermind may swap any card from their hand from another player's hand randomly before each trick.
Wow. Okay.
You do that before every trick. So like that's just one of the abilities. And along with all the others, that's really where the crazy chaos comes in, which I love.
Of course.
If you know anything about me, I'm totally into these games. Honestly, everything except for the Rebel, I adored and really enjoyed about this game. And as we were playing the game, I think maybe after the second round, I had said something along the lines of, it'd actually be really cool if the Rebel had the ability to pick from those last two cards that aren't selected, that the mastermind and the team player pick for the rule and the trump. Those two remaining cards that are left over, the rebel player puts them into their hand and then discards any other two cards. So it gives them some more control after they know what the rule is and after they know what trump is. They can manipulate their hand a little bit more, knowing like, oh, maybe those last two cards were trump cards. Now they have two more trump in their hand. Or maybe they're able to get rid of a suit to short suit themselves to have more trump later. Or maybe the cards that were over there were higher numbers. Which then also leads into the mastermind and the team player have to be careful about which two cards they do leave. If they leave higher numbers or really good cards, they're leaving good stuff for the rebel. So now what you pick for Trump and what you pick as the rule versus what you leave left over is another layer of decision.
And to build on that then, could you also have it where the rebel potentially keeps the extra cards and just plays less cards, you know, ends up with cards at the end?
Has 10 in hand and just has 2 left over?
Yeah.
I guess you could. I mean, that also would be thematic. They're the rebel. They don't follow the rules, right?
Exactly. And then perhaps they've got more dynamism then a bit to see what happens in the tricks and then have these extra cards to play at the end. Just thinking out loud. So
it'd be pretty interesting.
If Manny Dominguez is listening, then that's one of Ryan's genius ideas. See what you think. And anybody, of course, who has the game, it's to try, right? Are you going to perhaps incorporate that in one of your plays?
I think I will, but only because I've played the game before. Okay. Always want to preface with, the first time you're playing it, play the game rules as written, because you might have a different experience than I did. You might actually enjoy the Rebel player the way it's meant to be played. Maybe you find that it has more control than I do. Obviously, this is the opinion of one man, so take that as you will. The thing is, though, I really do enjoy the game, and I'm looking forward to playing it more. I really want to try it at 3 players, just to see what it's like without the Rebel involved at all. And see if it's just so streamlined in those 3-player games that maybe that's the only way I end up playing it. But I do believe if I play with the Rebel again at 4 players, I would like to institute the giving them access to those 2 cards just to see how it plays.
And I'm sure we'd appreciate if you do get a chance to do it. Please feedback. Would love to know how you get on with it. But like I always say, Ryan, if you want to go for a wild flavor of ice cream, you've got to appreciate vanilla first, because then at least you know what you're stepping up to. So huge advocate for playing as intended and then mixing it up once you've got the gist of it, if you want to see what happens when you twist up some of the rules.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
There we go. Ice creams and all.
All right. Well, those were our 2 trick-taking games for the day. We had a couple more games we wanted to mention that aren't trick-taking. It's going to be weird because it's a main episode, not a Oops No Trick Takers, but we're going to let it happen because
it's a hybrid. It's a...
Yes. This next game, Wizard's Cup, which is designed by Seiji Kanai, the same designer of Love Letter, Chronicle, Cheaty Mages, and many more. Very prolific designer.
Indeed.
Released a new game called Wizard's Cup that was available at Essen. We've mentioned it in the past just briefly on a couple episodes. As Patrick and I had been showing some interest in this game, it had some flavors of Duel Boy and of Challengers. So I was immediately interested. Patrick was interested. We knew Candace from Board Game Geek went to Essen. She was amazing, was able to buy us a couple copies, which we paid for. Just want to throw that out there. These are our copies, not review or anything. All the thoughts are our own. She has also talked about it on her podcast. So if you want to go check it out, you can see what she said. But we're going to talk about it for a little bit here since we've both had the chance to play this game now. So Patrick, would you like to explain how the game plays first before we get into it?
Yeah, this was a game I'd highly anticipated. Put on my list for Essen, Ryan. Then decided I didn't want it. And then retrospectively went back and ordered it from a guy in Germany who went to Essen.
That's true. I forgot you did end up doing it that way. Candace only got me a copy.
So as they say, when there's a wizard, there's a way. So actual thoughts on this game properly. I gave it a quick go. I was at a convention, brought this to a convention in the UK, played it with somebody who I play games with quite often, was ordering a Thai meal, placed my order, waiting for the food to arrive, and got a couple of games of this in. So it's a super quick play. And we messed up a little bit because the rule book's a fairly good translation, but you kind of just need to read through the lines a little bit in terms of, okay, you know, it's Japanese, probably translated into English. So just give it a digest the information to make sure you're playing correctly. We thought it was okay initially. And the guy who I played it with turned around and said, look, I probably need to play this a bit more. So he said, fair enough. Wizard's Cup got packed up, brought away from the convention with, have I done the right thing? Then another friend I brought this to the other week, and we played. It's one of these games that it's so fast and so quick, you can literally just say, shall we re-rack and go again? And
so easy.
Yes, exactly. This is, you could literally, as I did with a Thai meal, you could play this pretty much anywhere while you're waiting for something. I don't know about a coffee. I probably wouldn't chance it. But food-wise or whatever, you're in McDonald's and you just get a game of this in. So we played.
Yeah, the box says 20 minutes. But I honestly think you can get it in like 5 to 10.
5 to 10 at best.
I think coffee is reasonable.
Okay, yeah. If you've got a good barista and they're brewing it for a while, they've got the espresso on the go, and you've got your wizard.
Good fancy latte.
Exactly. And the wizards come out and play. So this game, literally, you are, as we played the game, we've realized that there's a meta to this game. So it's not just, because you can play it and you can flip the cards over and you can go, oh, well, you've won that one, I've won this one, you've won that one, job done. And then you think, you're using the same cards for best of three rounds and you're getting to know your opponent's deck. So the first round might not mean much, but by the time you come to the second round and the third round, seeing the combinations of cards that come out and play off against each other, and you're thinking to yourself, well, last round he did this, next round he did that. And to me, that's where the game is. Doubly so, triply so, etc. If you play this often with the same person, you can really get into each other's head. And I think this is pretty much Psychology Cup. It's a game of trying to read your opponent rather than necessarily playing the game, which is weird to say. What do you think?
That's a great way to sum it up. The bluffing, double bluffing decisions at the beginning are really part of it. Like I said, it's similar to Challengers, if you've ever played that game before. Once you've created your deck, you're just watching it go. You don't have any decisions after you've stacked your five cards in front of you and you're flipping them over. What's done is done. You just have to hope you win. But the decisions beforehand, especially going into round two and or round three, once you've seen your opponent's cards and you know what they have, you get to reorder them in the start of the round. So maybe you reorder based on what you saw last time and your opponent's doing the same thing. So now you're getting into each other's heads of, okay, where are they going to put that card? In this game, there are specific mages that have weaknesses to other mages. So there was one game I actually just played a couple days ago. I had two of the grass mages, where one of them, when it's in your discard pile, boosts your other mage by +3. Mm-hmm. And I had it set up where, and that's a grass mage. And my opponent had a fire mage at the time. First round, ordered it wrong, demolished him. Won all five mages. But second round, he knew that was coming and had ordered it properly, where mine just got immediately discarded, because the way scoring works to determine if your mage wins or not is whoever has the highest strength. So they range from 1 to 10. If I flip over an 8, Patrick flips over a 5, my 8's higher than his 5, I'm winning that mage. His gets discarded, he flips a new one. But if your mage has a weakness to your opponent's mage, yours loses regardless of its value. I play a 10, Patrick plays a 2, but my 10 is a weakness to whatever his 2's mage is. Mine gets discarded.
Right, Pokemon-esque in that sense.
Yep, exactly. And the player aid does a great job. It's got on the backside of it. It follows the flow of what beats what, along with the rulebook showing it. But essentially, you have that level, because it's like, once my opponent knew I had these 2 grass mages and that he had this fire mage, I'm like, oh crap, there's no way I'm going to be able to beat this now. So I'm going into round 3 thinking, okay, what's the order I need to do this in? How am I going to be able to get rid of his fire mage before my grass mages come out, before it's too late? Do I put them at the very bottom of the deck to hope that he gets his fire out early because maybe he thinks my grass is going early? And like, that's what you're doing, all within the span of like 30 to 45 seconds. Sometimes a little bit longer if you are AP prone. But the beauty of it is you can spend that much time, or you can just be like, you know what? I'm just going to take 5 seconds, just see what happens. Let's go.
Throw it together.
And just, yep. And just pray to the wizard gods that you do it.
Yeah. So the one thing to mention in this game, you, at the start, before you compile your deck, you know one card of your opponents. They choose a random card, and that's a card that you've got to use. So straight away, you've got some known information before you go into round one. And also, of your 6 cards, one of them you can set aside as a substitute. And that substitute may or may not come into play. So you as a player, you go through your... Originally, you're creating the deck, albeit one of them's been randomly taken out by your opponent that you've got to use. You're creating your deck of 6 wizards. Your deck and your opponent's deck are identical, 18 or so cards. And it's all about, right, what do I use as my substitute? Will it come into action? Is it going to see the table? But I know I've got these 5. And it's, again, like Ryan said, it's this headspace that you can find yourself in. You can make it arbitrary random, but for me, that would really make it a terrible game. The fun is in trying to outthink and rethink what your opponent's going to do. It's worth mentioning that we've discussed numerical values, we've discussed weaknesses, but the cards also have abilities on them as well. For example, we mentioned all high value wins. Well, there is a card with a female witch on it that literally says you beat cards that are higher value, only sort of lower value cards can beat you. And once we discovered the witch, she came out, we both had her, we both tried to play off against each other, and we sort of saying, well, you're stuff now because all your cards are high cards. And then the opponent I was playing with found another clever way to maneuver themselves out of that situation. So it feels nicely balanced, doesn't it? You think, it's broken. You know, this card is going to, like you did with your, the grass mage, this card is going to whip through your entire deck. And then you realize, oh, perhaps they've thought about this.
Yeah, there are absolutely cards that have counters to other cards. And there are some that just seem broken until you realize, oh no, I just need this mage in or this wizard in to stop them from doing it. The only problem is the 6 cards you pick at the beginning are the same ones you have every round. So if you just get unlucky and not choose the right wizard, and there's just one wizard that your opponent has that just will trounce you every time, you can't really come back from that. But like we just said, the game is 10, 20 minutes max. You can re-rack and play a whole new game and pick all new mages and think, well, are they going to pick that mage again? Are they going to have that? Like, it did so well last game for them. Are they going to keep it? Let me look at the mages, or I keep calling them mages, wizards.
How can I counter it, right?
Yeah, wizards that can counter it. And it creates, like you said, the meta just within that small time frame of playing the same person. Which wizards do you pick? The one that randomly gets picked out for you, you already know. So there's a lot of decision in such a small game that doesn't really have a lot of decision.
Throw it in a backpack, because the other nice thing they do is all your opponent's cards have got black or white on the back, and yours the opposite. So it couldn't be easier to set up. You take your cards, you take a random card, like I said, and you're pretty much ready to go. This is... could be one of the ultimate travel games. It's there with black trick-taking black and white bears, really tiny box. Wizards Cup's a bit bigger, but so portable. I love what they've done with the production.
Yeah, it's great. I would say it's a slight step up from Duel Boy. That's like the ultimate travel game of just a pack. Because this game, you theoretically could play the way you do Duel Boy, where you don't need a table. It'd be a little bit more cumbersome. You'd have to put the wizards that you don't select in your like your pocket, I guess. And then you'd have to find a way to do your sub card. So like, it's definitely going to be way trickier. You really need a table. But you, if you worked hard enough and you were waiting in line somewhere at a convention or whatever, you could play this game in your hand. It would be possible.
I was going to say like a magic trick. I was struggling for wizard puns, if I'm completely honest, Ryan, with you.
I honestly think this is the first time you tried a pun this whole episode, if I'm not mistaken.
It might actually be. I did an IKEA joke earlier, but that was just the wardrobes. That wasn't a pun.
This is great. I'm digging it, though. Let's keep it going.
I can't believe it. I'm shocked at myself. I'll find one. Yeah. We'll find one. But as for the Wizards Cup game, now I have to ask the most crucial question that everybody's been dying to hear from you. Compared to Duel Boy, can you please take me out of my misery? What's the prognosis, early thoughts?
Duel Boy is still better.
Okay.
I think the meta, the decisions, the play space in Duel Boy is more interesting and more thought-provoking.
Okay.
In Wizards Cup, it's all about the initial draft, what you're picking as your wizards, and then watching them go, seeing how you failed or succeeded in that round, and slightly adjusting from there. Whereas Duel Boy, it's got those meaty choices of which cards do you play when, knowing that you're going to run out of your hand and have to lose the game. You might have expensive cards, being limited to what you can play. Yeah, it's what I really love with Marvel Champions, being limited to I have got four cards in my hand. I want to play all of them, but I can only afford one or two of them. What do I pick? Duel Boy has sort of that same limitation. And I love that puzzle, figuring out, what do I play in my hand when to time everything right to win? Wizards Cup's a little bit more laid back. So I think just in that regard, Duel Boy beats it out. But I will say they are pretty much completely different games as far as feel goes. Mm-hmm. Like the vibe I'm getting from playing the game. Duel Boy, while being silly, is a little bit more of a serious game, whereas Wizards Cup is just a silly game all the way through.
That's your 2 minutes before your Starbucks arrives, right? Or maybe five, or whatever you can stretch it to. So that's really interesting, because you said about the card economy in Duel Boy, which of course I have had the privilege of playing with you and really enjoy that. And obviously in War of the Ring, the card game, there's a similar thing. You choose the card to play, choose a card to go out of play for a little bit, which might come back later. Whereas you've got your wizards, you know that you're sat with them for three rounds, so fasten your seatbelt, because those are the ones you've got to run with, albeit it does resolve really fast and plays really fast as well, so which is a string to its bow, as we've said. So I think we're probably recommending this game. However, I will caveat, it's probably quite difficult to find.
At this moment, yeah. At this moment. I believe it's going to be available at the upcoming Tokyo Game Market, which obviously still requires importing. But I'd hope, based on the production and the fact that it was available at Essen, and it's getting some pretty good buzz, that it might be available in a broader audience or spectrum availability. So who knows?
Who knows?
I could easily see this game being available because it's a Seiji Kanai game. Mm-hmm. He's made a lot of games that easily get out, because once you make a game like Love Letter and it's just available in a billion different versions all over the place, you tend to make a game and people look.
They do as well. The designer with that sort of credibility as well, and having released successful titles. So watch this space. It was sold for about 10 euros, I believe, at Essen. Sadly, I paid quite a bit more for it. So it was worth it for me, but definitely see what's going to come out in the future, and hopefully Wizards Cup will be one of his upcoming games for the English market.
Absolutely. On to our last game that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, it's a game called Ito. To be honest, Ryan, I don't give many games a 10 out of 10, and I certainly didn't give our Eco 10 out of 10, albeit I'll talk about it to death on our podcast episodes. Well, I just, it's kind of a troll thing now, isn't it? I'll just get the word RECO into an episode if I can. So that's me getting it into this episode. Ito was a punt. It was a game that I saw in a bring and buy at a convention, completely in Japanese with a spider crawling across it. And I really didn't know what to expect. It's a game by 326. Okay, just a, it's a number, so it's easy for me to pronounce in this case. Japanese designer. And all the cards were in Japanese. In fact, somebody had taken the trouble to sleeve the whole thing and stuck a load of Japanese cards in a bag on the back. So it was, do I buy this now and see what's what? Anyway, I convinced my group to play it the same evening. We realized that you didn't actually need the Japanese topic cards that came with it, because the main deck goes from 1 to 100. Have you ever played The Mind, Ryan?
I have. It's been quite some time, but I'm familiar.
Wavelength?
Is this like The Mind?
Wavelength?
I have played Wavelength. Okay. Yes, that I do on that game's great.
So this game is, for a pitch, like The Mind and Wavelength had a baby without the downtime.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Okay, so you're playing a game. If you've got a copy of The Mind, you can try this game out. Of course, we always advocate buying the actual product if you can find it. And I believe an English version has just come out. Essentially, you're given a card at the start, a number. You're just given a number. And your goal is to play that number in order with the other players, playing them face down, face up in order, in order to progress to the next level. There's three levels, and each level you get a new card. So second level, two cards, third level, three cards. And you regain a life. You try not to lose these lives as a group. So what we found is on BGG, there's a category list, and we had this game turned into a huge meta game, role-playing game for us. But what it's meant to do, you're given a number, and it could be, for example, animals from smallest to largest. And small might be a number one, and largest might be an elephant, for example. And you sat there and you're describing your thing. So if you've got a number 56, for example, what do you say? I mean, what's your number 56? You might say, well, I've got a leopard, for instance, because it's not huge, but it's not tiny. And then all the other players will go around and say their thing. And you realize somebody else on the table might have something in the 50s, but you can't discuss your value. So
baby leopard.
Baby leopard. And what you have to do then is you have to retrospectively go back and alter your description, which you totally can do. You just can't say what your number is, which is great. So everybody goes around, has a bit of a chat, see what the numbers are when they're revealed, and see if you guys play them in order, which is what makes the game so interesting. We literally took that idea and we were full on role playing this. It was worst to best excuses to being late. And we open with, I'm sorry I'm late, but, you know, I think I've just run over Doris. I think that was my thing. Just run over Doris. I'm really sorry. There's been a crash, blah, blah, blah. And somebody else said, well, I have actually died. I've actually died. I'm dead. I can't turn up to work. And there was somebody else with a nonsense excuse. Maybe the car battery was flat. I can't quite remember. Anyway, I had number 100, didn't I, Ryan? I had 100. And this person was stressing. They were saying, I've actually died. So it's going to be stronger than running over Doris. And in the end, I was forced to play my 100 out too early. Of course, 100 is as high as it can go. But there's so many interesting topics and situations where you can find yourself in with this game. And we had the best to worst things for lunch. And I said, well, I've got a 5-star lunchbox from Amazon. It's hot. It heats the food. It keeps it cold. It comes with lobster and chips. And I had a really high number, Ryan, but somebody said that sounded awful. But then somebody else came in with a big bento box that is all gourmet, and you fold up and you open up. And his description was so much better than mine, even though my number was higher. And it's really about getting to know the players and what comes out. I haven't laughed that much in years, to be honest with you. And I would highly recommend just trying this game out. I mean, one of them was invent your own superhero. And we were coming up with concepts about, I think I had I had a terrible superhero. I'm probably not even going to share it with you. It was dreadful, but it was supposed to sound cool. And people were saying, oh, you know, what's your superhero's name? You start going into it, the metagame evolves. And people around us were at this con. They were saying, what the hell are you playing? And we were finding we were metagaming, bringing topics that had come up earlier into our current questions as well. So inter alia fun employed, inventing your own theme park, come up with a name for the theme park. What do they do at the theme park? So what number are you? I can't stress this enough, that if you have a copy of The Mind, or if you've got a deck that goes maybe the game from 0 to 100, 0 to 99, whatever it is, try it. We found it best. It works best with one card per person. And just seeing if you can play them in order and just coming up with all these different topics. Maybe some are, your group's not super drama, amateur dramatic type, so you just want to describe the cards, or maybe you full on go into it. What do you think based on the description? Am I pitching you a game here, Ryan, that you might be intrigued to try?
Oh yeah, you have my interest peaked completely. This sounds like a game that I could get Michelle, my wife, to play, and a couple of her friends whenever they come over. We're usually playing lighter party games, so this sounds like it'd be perfect for the lineup.
Oh, it was. We had a teacher there. The sorry I'm late excuse. He sort of said, "Well, imagine you're a teacher and you're in a corridor and you're stuck in this corridor for 27 minutes because you can't walk past the other person." I just went to sleep that night thinking about all these things that had come out in the conversation that we were having. What a great group I've played with, first of all. One of them was a stranger. And the laughter that it evoked, and for such a simple concept. You can play it as written, as the rules write, and there's different ways to play it. And you can also take it to the next level if you want to. So I'd highly recommend checking it out.
So question, actually, it's been bugging me. What number did the person who said, I'm dead, have? If you had 100, did they have 99? Or like,
I think
how
they were
high...
in the high 90s.
Okay.
But they said the highlight of the con for them was me trying to sort of role play the fact that I'd just killed Doris. You know, there's an awful situation and I was trying to stress how bad it was. And retrospectively, you're trying to go back and... As you can see your number, your high number that you had, and you think you've given a great description, deteriorating in front of your eyes as other people come in with more outlandish, more compelling things, you're then trying to claw it back and sort of say, oh, no, it's a terrible situation. And I think, you know, I'm going to perhaps go to the prison for the rest of my life. This is awful. This is awful. And people are saying, oh, well, you know, I'm dead. I'm sorry. You know, so good, Ryan. It's such a treat. And it was a complete punt. Complete punt. And sometimes you find these things.
It's amazing to just pick a game like that, sort of blindly going in and it turning out to be one of your best games of the year, it seems like. I will say, and especially in party games like this, it really can live or die by the group.
Agreed.
As you sort of just alluded to a minute ago, where you said we had the best group to play this with, I feel like if it gets hyped up too much, but you don't have the right group for it, it might not go well for you. So keep that in mind. If you have tried playing The Mind or Wavelength, which this game seems to combine both of mm-hmm. those, if you've tried those games before and they fell flat with your group, I don't know if this game will fix that for you completely. Would you agree with that, Patrick? Or
I would agree. The person in my group did say, okay, I don't know if I need to keep Wavelength now I've played this. And another person in the group said, well, this fixes The Mind for me. This is what I want The Mind to be. But he's a teacher. He's a creative guy. And I will stress as well, you don't have to full-on roleplay this. Of course, if you want to, by all means, that's where the fun is, I think. But if you literally just want to say, best hobbies, or most boring hobbies, worst to best, and you just say, well, I think X, and you think X, and just have a conversation, if you're not the dramery type, that's fine too. So I think, Ryan... Yes, but also you can dial it back as much or dial it up as much as you want to, which makes Ito very versatile. It contains, it's all games in one as we described it. You've got the bluffing, you've got the meta game, you've got getting to know each other. It's just phenomenal, really. Without overselling it, which I think I am here. You owe yourself to try the game if you're at all curious by what I'm saying. because it can be free of charge if you want to give it a go, if you have a deck of numbers.
Like you said, hyping it up. Sometimes when you find that game that really hits with you and your group, it's hard to not hold it back. So it's always great to see when you do find a game like that. And if anybody who's been listening so far thinks that this game might work for you, then absolutely give it a try. Like you said, if you've got a copy of The Mind, you can do that first. And if you like it enough, consider trying to find a original copy of it, which I know there's a couple different versions, like English and Japanese. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are ways to get a hold of the original one if you want.
And what you can do, if you do find a Japanese one, you can scan the cards with Google and translate them, as Ryan likes to do with games as well. But I will say that's quick enough to do. They are leaning into Japanese culture a little bit as well, which is cool and is fun, of course. And there is a nice list of categories on Board Game Geek. You can totally just wing it and come up with categories that you think would work for your group as well. Kind of my favorite things style that brings out getting to know people, which is why these games are so fun. So definitely on board. If you find a copy in the wild, check it out. And if not, check it out anyway, because you have the means to do so.
Because you have to. Because
you have to.
Because
Patrick said so. And just to, for clarity here, most games, Ryan, I tend to give a rating of 7, 7.5. Really good games, really, really outstanding games, 8s, 9s. So this is one of the few 10s that I've given in the years. So I don't normally get this hyped up about games. Our Echo is definitely not that on that end of the spectrum. It's all right, I'll be honest. It's worth playing. Just to give you some perspective.
That's amazing, though. I'd love to hear how this game goes for you after multiple plays, if it stays as a 10, if playing with different players maybe changes up the aspect of the game. I'd really like to see how that goes. And I think I will probably be playing this with the holidays coming up, family. This seems like a great game for that. So I'm sure I'll probably have some comments on it after I get a play or two of it in.
It's a scream. And like I say, we found one card every round works the best. But of course, play it by the rules as well. There's different ways to play. And according to Mr. Ben from travel-games.co.uk, great guy, sells lots of these types of games. He says there's quite a few variants out there as well. So I'm sure it's literally, hey, here's conversation, the game. You decide how fun you're going to have of an evening. We've given you the tools to make you laugh. Off you go. String your thoughts together, as it says. And we look forward to, if anybody does want to try this, please feedback to us and let us know how you got on as well. I am not responsible for your enjoyment, but I do advocate giving it a go.
All right. Anything else? Any final thoughts on that game? Any of the games we talked about today?
Well, it says string your thoughts together. I thought I strung it together quite well. That was a very weak and loose pun. So we've got it all tied up.
It's a deep cut, because if you don't know the game enough, you're going to miss that. But if you see the box art of Ito, it'll make more sense.
There we go. So.
All right. Well, thanks again, as always. You've been listening to another episode of Trick Talkers. You can find all of our information on our link tree, which will be in the show notes below. And if you want to reach out to us with any questions, comments, recommendations, whatever it might be, you can reach us on Twitter at Trick Talkers, or you can email us at tricktalkers@gmail.com.
And just quickly, one of the listeners, Steve, suggested a trick avoidance or hearts episode. We are thinking about doing a trick avoidance episode in the future. And I know me and Ryan have got Rebel Princess to have a few more plays of and report our findings on, which is another game that was popular at Essen.
Yes, looking forward to getting a couple more plays in this weekend. And like you said, I think that might be our next episode that we do, or in the near future, about trick avoidance. So be good to talk about that.
Looking forward to it. And as Ryan said, thank you everyone for listening.
See you around.
See you around.